Now, here we are discussing, we shall now discuss three extraordinary managers or executives who demonstrated the power that comes from distinguishing mental models from reality. We are again revisiting three cases. The first one is A.J. Lafley, ex-CEO of Procter & Gamble. The second is a person, Bob Young, the founder of Red Hat. And then the third one is Piers Handling, who was associated with the Toronto International Film Festival. What these people did in three different unrelated areas, let's see now. Let's take the first one, P&G, Procter & Gamble. The background is year 2000 and P&G warns Wall Street for the second consecutive quarter, it would miss out on the profit targets. The indication was given to them. The growth is slowing, profits are falling, market share is dropping and share price fallen by 50% in the previous 6 months. So what's the headline in a magazine called Advertising Age? Does P&G matter? Does P&G matter? P&G is a giant, FMCG giant. Does it really matter? That's a question that crops up suddenly. And it's a question of huge concern for P&G, right? Now what happens? Lafley launched liquid Tide. Tide with bleach and compact Tide, this is basically detergents, as you know. All successful extensions of the P&G brand. And SK2, a tiny brand in Japan, was brought to global prestige by him. These are some of the things which Lafley did. He had succeeded the earlier CEO of P&G, who had to be unceremoniously fired. He did not perform, some controversies were there, so he had to be removed, right? And he could not be groomed as per customary P&G practice for the position because of lack of time. He had to suddenly take over and get into the action, right? Still, he faced the challenge that he would have tested, the most experienced CEO. Something is given to you, a hot plate is given to you, you have to carry it with you. So how do you do it? Okay. Now, what is the issue? His predecessor, the person who was holding the position before, saw P&G as an R&D company. He felt that heavy investment in R&D will reignite sales, will bring back sales and growth, and tripled innovation spending is what he actually planned and did. And then the strategy was a financial disaster as a result. Was this gentleman wrong? One cannot call him a flop or wrong. He did what he did was the best thing. Imagine if it had clicked, we will sing praises about him, will we not? Now, I'm not taking sides or I'm not attacking anything. I'm just opening up all of us to think that this did not click because he took a single stance. When you take a single stance, you win or you lose. When you take an integrative stance, you win and lose. Certain things which are not required will not be there, but certain things which are required, you'll be going ahead. And through the steps of the four steps which we are discussing in chapter number 2, after the action is over, you take a feedback and you come back to the architecture, to the causality, and then to the salience, and reset your salience. The beauty about taking a decision using the integrative thinking is, after the action is over, you're still open enough to say, look, we failed. We did not consider this particular architectural structure. We did not think of these causality thoughts. And we did not give this importance in terms of salience. So that part of it is what perhaps this gentleman had not done. He was linear in his thinking. He was so sure that R&D will work. If it had clicked, he would have been a hero. But it didn't click, so he became a zero. Right? And now the other persons, the people in this company, the other senior executives, they thought differently. They felt that they saw P&G as a marketing and a brand building company. And they felt investment in research should fall back on historical levels. And it had worked in the past. They felt that the focus should be on marketing and brand building. Were they right? Yes, as well as no. The CEO did not click. He was a flop. Was he wrong? Need not be. We are discussing this whole thing based on integrative thinking and action. What we are discussing it, this is an either or approach. This is also an either or approach. These two approaches by themselves may click, may not click. This is what we do in most cases. Now, what did Lafley do? He treated the two stands not as options, but as hypothesis and not truth. hypothesis, assumptions from where we start working till the assumptions are proved wrong or right. Right? Markets were changing, competition was fierce, and hence historical levels of R&D research spend did appear inadequate. No matter how much you spend on R&D, it was not enough because the markets were changing and newer products had to be coming out frequently. Larger investment could not be the only answer. Lafley had no intention of settling for a trade-off. It was his problem and he was to find a creative resolution. He said, I don't want to make a compromise, this or that, let me see what I can do differently. Combination of A and B, maybe something totally different, C, right? He studied whether there were other better ways to produce innovation. He questioned the causal relation reasoning that said useful innovation output is directly proportional to the dollars invested in it. What's the general feeling when you're putting your money into R&D? R&D is a money that goes in which pays back much, much later. Because we do not know when would the R&D be successful in the purpose for which it has been set up in terms of a new product. The new product may come out from the R&D after 1 year, maybe 2 years, maybe 6 years. So all the money, all the resources spent during that time may be a write-off if it doesn't click. So we do not know when the return on investment will take place, right? He discovered that innovation was broadly distributed. We used to have people who were innovating and they were not focused. They were on different segments. So we had the solo inventors, the one-man show, the academics, and the small companies were disproportionately represented, while big companies had a lower share than would be expected given the size and the resources. They're the huge, large companies had all the money in the world. And they had all the resources, the people, the manpower, the time, etc. Right? And the risk. And they were not much into innovation because the focus perhaps is more on the production and the profit making. The smaller ones who are inventing, who are into all these inventions and innovations were very much fragmented. Now this is a thought which came to him, which he realized, this is the truth, this is a reality. Big corporations have an advantage in developing, testing and commercializing breakthrough ideas. Free of preconceptions about right way to innovate, Lafley saw a way to hitch small company inventiveness to P&G's vast network resources. Let's make use of the small company's innovativeness to make our things happen. It's a win-win situation. He set a target for P&G to obtain 50% of its innovations from outside the company. By connecting with a wide variety of outside innovators, P&G will focus on developing and commercializing them. Today we talk about contract production. Pharmaceutical companies, FMCGs, under their brand, their products with the same quality, after quality training given to the vendors, it is made in the vendors' factories. Now, by doing this, we are saving on our own time and core competencies not getting drained away, right? He termed this initiative as Connect and Develop. Lafley believed that Connect and Develop initiative would enable P&G to parlay a relatively modest investment in innovation into above average growth. It's like a leverage. You just make this change of doing a Connect and Deliver and you'll find that the major changes are happening. Imagine a one-man show inventor who has got all the ideas, he's got all the inventiveness in him. If a large company engages him to invent something for them, then, and they pay him back, they compensate him well, they give him all the facilities required, they train him into the commercial aspects of the invention, he grows, he gets prominence, the company also gets its own things taken care of. That is how you merge the small and the big together. Right? Lafley believed that Connect and Develop initiative would enable P&G to parlay a relatively modest investment in innovation into above average growth. The initiative Connect and Develop was greeted with anxiety and dismay by the research staff. The research staff perhaps felt that, look, this is our domain. It's our company and we know our products. We are working at a very basic level. We know the entire picture. If you're going to give it to some third party outside, they may not perhaps, it may not pay off. They may work out of context. Now this is the apprehension, the type of anxiety with these people probably had. And Lafley responded that the initiative would double or treble the productivity of PNG's research. He had a different thinking. So he said, no, things will be different if you outsource it. The first fruit of the initiative was a spin brush, a low-price battery-operated oscillating toothbrush. PNG acquired it early in its commercialization from a small company and added its Crest brand to it. There's a brand called Crest, very famous brand of PNG. And to that, Lafley added the spin brush product. Right? The spin brush was an instant success, and in 4 years, it developed into a $160 million product line. A phenomenal success. Right? Lafley did not do it alone. He would be the first to give PNG's top innovation executives credit for formulating and executing Connect and Develop. Integrative management is not a domain of one single person. It's a teamwork. What is important is that there is one person who thinks integrative and he influences others to think integrative. When others get influenced to think integrative, we have an integrative team out there. And it's this team with the integrative manager leading that actually performs the whole action. So one of the responsibilities, one of the initiatives, or one of the imperatives that the integrative manager needs to do, he needs to develop integrative thinking among the people, among the stakeholders with whom he is associated. Right? They would not have brought the idea to fulfillment, this team, without Lafley's ability to distinguish between reality and models of reality. His unyielding high standards, his assumption of personal responsibility, and his willingness, eagerness to rethink the entire problem from the ground up. All these things he was able to influence his team around, and that's why they were able to fall in line and produce the results. Lafley created a leadership environment that encouraged research executives to push their idea as far as it would go. Right? Integrative thinking should not be confused with solo heroic leadership. It's not a one-man show. It is leadership all the same with teamwork. The emphasis is it's a leadership with teamwork. In fact, a leader is a leader is a leader because of people who are following him. Either it could be a thought leader, he could be an action leader. Either ways, what happens? There is a follower. So no team, no leadership. Right? Now we come to the next case, case, if I can call it, which is talking about how Red Hat found profits in free software. This has already been covered in one of the earlier sessions, but I'll just give a brief on this. This is a fascinating story in the technology sector about the rising challenge by Linux. We all know about Linux as an open source code software, the open source operating system, to Microsoft's one monopolistic dominance of the market for the operating system software. Microsoft on one side, which makes licensed software and sells it, gives updates as and when the updates come, charges you for that. Linux open source software, freely available, downloaded, and which comes out with versions which we need to keep on getting it. Two different formats, right? In 1980s, two new software was developed based on Unix, an operating system invented in 1970s by AT&T, Bell Labs, and made available at no cost. A breakthrough. It was Linus Torvalds, one of the 1,000 programmers, further developed it with contributions from various other enthusiastic users. And he suggested improvements that were pouring in were incorporated by Torvalds to launch a robust software which he called it as Linux, the famous Linux, that could handle heavy-duty corporate applications. But corporations were not buying because the market was fragmented with uncopyrighted versions floating around. Anything that comes free or cheap, which does not have a commitment from the seller about after-sales service and AMCs and whatever, people would hesitate to take. There's a time-tested proven system which is perhaps expensive, but people would rather go in for that as a first choice because people are dealing with their own businesses which cannot afford to play around. This is a thought process that normally comes to people's mind. So corporations were not buying because the market was fragmented with uncopyrighted versions of floating around. So when the Linux came up, there was small, every person was creating some small packages and trying to say that I am also in the fray. So that doesn't give confidence to a solid company which is wanting to buy some software which is lasting. Linux was actually cheap, and it could be bought on the payment of a small fee for a CD-ROM of the software. User could mount the purchased software on as many computers as they wished. Red Hat was one of the companies that sold Linux. Impressed by the product, Bob Young joined it as a CEO. So from his experience as a distributor, Young knew that the still tiny market for Linux software was growing rapidly. But the business was going to hit a ceiling unless it found a new business model. It's like a commodity which you can buy from anywhere. And we all know about commodities. When you go to buy a commodity, you know, there's so much amount of undercutting. It's a dog-eat-dog market. So Bob Young felt that I should do something different. I should do something different because this is a very good model which needs to be properly packaged. And so there were two dominant models that in existence in the market at that point of time. Young did not think either model had much of a future. How did he handle the issue? He needed to look into the two models. Now, what are the two models? The first model is a classical proprietary model, which is a Microsoft type of a model. Big players like Microsoft and Oracle sold only operating software, not the source code. We all know it. Users used to pay more for enhancement and modifications, and also for removing any bug while using the software. So anything that is to be serviced, you need to pay for it, right? Now, the other model was free, meaning cheap, available with source code on CD-ROM, like any other commodity, and Linux was a major player. These are the two models available. Now, what did he do? Let's see. Young considered proprietary software inefficient and obsolescent way to develop software, while free software were problematic as well. Young argued that no one can make money selling Linux because all this stuff was free, and if you started to charge money for it, someone else would come in and price it lower, undercutting. Young had to find some way of adding value to Linux that didn't involve improving the code. What did he do? That means finding something salient, something very useful, something very important about Linux that other programmers and distributors overlook. Some facet of Linux which others are still not seeing. Some reality of Linux which others have not seen as their reality. Young found that point of salience in corporate buying habits. He looked harder and he suddenly noticed that corporate buying habits had certain flavor. Young realized that because big companies are making decisions they will have to live with for 10 to 20 years, they want to buy from industry leader only. Isn't it a fact? Proceeding from that insight, Young discovered a causal relationship between sales level and sustainability that his rivals had overlooked. Now here is Bob Young. Red Hat now have to find if there were a way to manage the flood of updates. If you notice, he's wearing a red hat, okay? How can Red Hat establish itself as a coveted number one position? By imposing order and control on the chaotic process by which improvements to Linux are developed and captured. He need to have some means by which once the Linux is bought by a customer or somebody, I need to sustain him with me. So what did he do? Let's see. A typical Linux operating system is some 800 to 1000 different packages all compiled together. They are updated once or twice a year. That amounts to 3 to 6 updates a day, right? No corporate systems administrator can handle these changes even if software is free. All of us know about updates, right? Whatever software we buy, there's updates coming up regularly. It happens in our mobile smartphones also. A lot of updates keep coming. They're automatically coming to us in many cases, but in a case like this, we have to keep on seeking the updates and keep on installing it. A system administrator in a company would find it very cumbersome if he buys a software like that. So there is a gap, as you call it in marketing. There was a gap which Bob Young noticed. He said, this gap is something where I can do something. I can fill it up. And so the thought process flows as follows. If you use Microsoft, you do not have that problem. Microsoft delivers you a new version once every 6 months and they tell you how to install it. You have this nice, safe, controlled deployment of your new software, right? You can see that serious corporate users were not going to use Linux. Although the price was right, they would not save money if they use free software where the systems administrators had to track all of the random updates. Very, very cumbersome and laborious. You may miss out also sometimes. Young was pleased with his resolution, which blended, which mixed, which brought together, which integrated the best elements of two competing business models in a new way doing business. He had now a more stable, reliable operating systems than Windows. Red Hat would have to find its way onto every hard drive in corporate America. Red Hat's programmers rewrote the Red Hat version of Linux so that it could be distributed over the internet instead of via CD-ROM. A slight change. They would put it up on every FTP file, that is file transfer protocol server, on the internet over the world. A strategy which they adopted. Young's goal was to give Linux away more efficiently than any of his competitors. It was a risky move, and Red Hat will have no income from new releases. But that was the price of making Red Hat Linux the de facto standard. The rest is history, as we know. In 1999, Red Hat went public and Young became a billionaire. Linux captured 25% of the server operating system market, and Red Hat held over 50% of Linux global market. It did not get trapped in the dot-com bust and continued to grow. Very simple. You buy the Linux from me, and all the updates I'll give you, I'll see that I service your updates. So you have no tensions. Systems administrators can be rest assured that the Red Hat people will come and take care of it. This was a very simple model in a market which would have been otherwise commoditized. Right? That's the success of Red Hat. This happened because Bob Young thought integrative. Not either, not or, but and. Young realized that existing software models were not reality. They were models accepted for coping with business dynamics. He did not rest until he found a new and a better business model. He took a personal responsibility for figuring out a new way to compete. And he read the existence of a trade-off as a signal to rethink from ground up. In doing so, he found clues to what was salient to corporate software buyers and causal relationship between industry, leadership and prosperity. Now, we come to a third case, a third gentleman, a third manager who has used integrative management in a very, very rare, the most unexpected place, the film festival, a film festival in Canada. And the gentleman goes by the names of Piers Handling, and this is titled as Buzz Machine That Ate Toronto. Toronto, the city in Canada. When Piers Handling joined the staff of the Toronto International Film Festival, TIFF, it was a very model of struggling startup. After working in different roles, Handling was appointed TIFF director with a mandate to make TIFF draw the same sort of excited notice enjoyed by the top European festivals like Venice, Berlin and Cannes. We must have all heard about the world famous Cannes Film Festival, wherein lots of movies are brought in, which are again screened and filtered, and the best movies are brought in there, and experts view these movies and give them awards. And these awards are very prestigious awards. This is a type of prestigious thing that TIFF wanted to become when Piers Handling took it over. They wanted to carve a niche in this film festival market and become globally known, right? Festivals draw buzz when there is a panel of industry luminaries to award prizes to the best movies in various categories. But Piers Handling believed that the presence of an elite jury made it difficult for the people who paid the festival bills with their ticket purchases to feel that the festival was truly theirs. At the same time, in the absence of prizes, it was difficult to draw media attention and generate buzz. Toronto was designed to be inclusive, populist, more people-oriented, and for the audience, and not designed to be festival for experts. Film producers wanted big crowds to create buzz that would draw big distributors. And distributors wanted a signal from the festival to judge which movies to buy. Everything was related with each other. More and more number of people should see the films. Distributors wanted to make money out of it. At the same time, the quality part of it had to be accepted by the experts. Now, too many things which appear to be conflicting. In most cases, we will settle for any one of the two. If you notice, in most of these film festivals which we see, you find exclusively good films which have been given awards. But as most of us know, these films are not popular with the masses. They are so exclusive that the masses cannot relate with the expertise that is there in the film production, the direction and other aspects of the movie. So such a good film gets lost and doesn't get commercially successful. Now here was a person, Piers Handling, who wanted to have a film festival format in which we get quality films which are qualified by the experts, at the same time it is popular with the people. So how to make this happen is a integrative thinking that he put himself into, right? Every player in the equation needed a buzz. The festival needed a buzz to attract an audience, the producers to sell their movies, and the distributors to decide which movies to buy. So all of them appear to be conflicting. If I do one, the remaining two will go for a toss, and vice versa. Buzz fed itself in a virtuous circle. Buzz needed a prize, but a prize itself with its negative overtones of elitism could kill the very buzz it was supposed to generate. In other words, it simply means that I need a lot of buzz, I need a lot of pomp, and I need a lot of noise to be made, and there has to be a lot of pomp. Now to make that thing happen, it cannot happen only with an exclusive few. It has to be with the exclusive few also with the masses, right? Handling understood these complex causal relationships and also appreciated how each piece linked to the other. As he thought through this complex causal map, a creative resolution began to take shape. TIFF's continued growth required a buzz-generating prize to continue into global elite. And that prize had to excite and involve moviegoers rather than make them feel left out. If prize required for buzz, let it be decided by the input from all, not from a few. Handling realized that People's Choice Award, which festivals filmgoers themselves voted, could become a buzz-generating vehicle that was truly populist in nature, transforming a traditionally elitist activity into something that belonged to every movie lover who attended the festival. Instead of the few experts awarding the film with an award, why don't we have the entire population who are actually the moviegoers watching and then putting their own views and awarding a film in conjunction with the elites awards as well. It's not only one group of people, but also the other group which also decides. Today when we talk about reality shows and television, for example, it's not awarded by only the experts or the panelists who are sitting there and watching the reality show. We also have this SMS stuff wherein people can message and give their views and give their opinions about how well the person performed or not, right? The structure behind that is to ensure that it's not only a few people who say that this dance is good or this song is good, but also the people who are watching in the television from their homes. Integrative, right? So taking it further, Piers Handling, that's him, and Piers Handling understood these complex causal relationships. When audience becomes a jury, they are the people who are judging the film, there's an incentive to see maximum movies. Competition satisfies media desire for a horse race. There's plenty of coverage and distributors get clear signal for buy. These are the thoughts which actually Piers Handling entertained. Results. What is the result? TIFF, not TIIF, became a global event. In 2005, it booked the largest volume of sales in a film festival. Critics declared TIFF as the largest, most influential, the most inclusive festival. Right? All this because Handling avoided confusing existing models with reality, did not settle for a solution that was a trade-off, took personal responsibility for a creative solution. Right? So now we are summing it up by talking about the common path to the unique solutions which all the three gentlemen had brought about. Lafley, Young and Handling, whom we discuss, illustrate the patterns common to many integrative thinkers. They separated models from reality, and instead of refuting, analyze the models. Instead of disputing, instead of criticizing, they analyze the models. They were open to it. They refused to accept mediocrity, second choice or third choice. They wanted really quality and a class and half measures. If the models did not meet the standards, they changed models, not standards. Took responsibility to discover and implement resolution. They did not choose now, but thought harder. They set themselves into thinking. Patience is a virtue of an integrative manager. Patience not to the point of procrastinating and delaying. Action is taken, at the same time you keep on contemplating. So they think. They do, but they also keep on thinking and doing. Now we come to the summary, friends. Conventional thinkers confuse models for reality. Integrative thinkers separate them by analyzing instead of refuting. Integrative thinkers refuse to accept compromise and seek new model that will have the best of all. Once they discover resolution that is satisfactory in all respects, they take responsibility for implementation. The message they took away when faced with unpleasant choices was not choose now, but think harder. They kept the whole in mind while working on the individual parts so that they reach a creative resolution, and drive for this resolution is a common factor among all of them. I'll give an example about, I conclude this session with an example of what many of us must be knowing, a place called Chokidani. A diner's delight turns into a total ethnic experience. A place called Chokidani at Rajasthan is a well-known place for its traditionalism. It's a type of a environment, a village type of a scenario is created, right? It's a place to experience Rajasthani village fair and dining. The Rajasthani Mela, as you call it. But since everyone cannot go there in Mumbai, Pune and other cities in India, resemblance of Chokidani was created so that people could feel the experience of Chokidani itself without going all the way to the Rajasthan. Like what we call it as a theme restaurant or the theme experience. Right? Within a sprawling area of about 220 square kilometers from the city, in the entire Rajasthani village has been created. This is one example which came to the mind when we were compiling these things, and that's a place where you can find integrative thinking. So with this, I conclude this session, friends, and thank you very much.